Hello, everybody. This is Scott Yates, Director of Communications and Producer Relations for the Washington Grain Commission, here with episode 111 of Wheat All About It, or what I've entitled Enlightenment Right This Way, Wheat Traders Talk Trade 2, about a panel discussion at the 2018 Tri-State Grain Growers Convention held in Portland on November 15th. The three traders were Brian Liedel from United Grain Corporation, Kirk Harmon of Columbia Grain, and Damon Filon with Tri-Cities Grain. This episode is devoted to answers to questions posed at the conclusion of their presentations. You can get a lot out of this episode without having listened to episode 110, but you really should. Before I get to the episode, I want to thank everyone listening. Listenership numbers are rising slowly but surely. With the ability to watch podcast listenership, I'm struck by how some podcasts are more popular than others. Episode 97, entitled, What? Me Retire? Lessons on Life After Farming, which featured two retired farmers, Jim Wellsby and Randy Cease, quickly shot to the top of the most listened to podcast. I agree it was a good podcast, but as the fellow who puts these productions together, I think they're all equally engaging and informative. So please, listen regularly. A few podcasts that might have missed your notice because of the Christmas holidays particularly deserve to be listened to. Episodes 104 and 105 are a two-part conversation with Kim Garland Campbell, an ARS scientist, and Karen Sanguinet, a WSU scientist, talking about wheat during the coldest time of the year. The two episodes entitled Dead of Winter, Alive with Life, Wheat Plants in the Cold, are full of little-known facts any farmer with winter wheat in the ground should be familiar with. A podcast I released on New Year's Day is also worth a listen. Kenny Thomas was a soldier with Bravo Company of the 3rd Rangers Battalion when all hell broke loose in what is remembered as Black Hawk Down. A singer-songwriter who was also a motivational speaker, I entitled Thomas's episode 106 presentation, An Example Others Can Follow, Inspiration from Black Hawk Down. Now that the holidays are over, please return to these three episodes as you go about your daily activities, because as all podcast listeners know, you can do two things at once. And remember, while most podcast platforms only keep 10 or more recent episodes, you can find every one of the podcasts I produced at the Washington Grain Commission website at wagrains.org. Go to the bottom of the page, click on Summaries, and navigate back through the podcasts. Before I get to this week's podcast, I wanted to tell you my favorite story from the 2018 Tri-State Grain Growers Convention. I'm standing at the elevator to go downstairs to a meeting when the door opens and out comes Lori Williams, part of the Washington Association of Wheat Growers staff, and perhaps the busiest person at convention, given that she organizes it. She is looking down at her phone and nearly collides with me. I laugh and she apologizes. Two young people are standing nearby and we enter the elevator together. The door closes and I ask where they're from. Fairfield, Washington, the young man answers. Oh, I say, do you listen to Wheat All About It? I'm not sure the young man knows what I'm talking about, but his wife says, I listen to it. I knew it was you as soon as I heard you laugh. First, what a great thing to be recognized for. Second, I didn't know that I laughed so much. Since the young woman's comment, however, I've been paying attention to my laughter as I produce these podcasts. And you know, I do laugh quite a bit, which isn't a bad thing, is it? Okay, let's get to episode 111. The three traders I identified above are sitting at a long table on a stage in front of the audience. Randy Fortenberry, the WSU economist, serves as the moderator and stands to one side. An audience of Washington, Idaho, and Oregon farmers, their spouses, landlords, agribusiness representatives, university staff, and others fill the ballroom where lunch was served. The traders have finished their presentations, listen to episode 110, and it's time for questions. Randy Fortenberry kicks things off. Brian Liedl answers first, followed by Kirk Harmon and Damon Filand.
I'm going to ask the first question, and then we'll throw it open to the audience. I don't know, maybe 2 or 3 weeks ago, USDA had come out with an estimate that the value of total agricultural exports from the U.S. this year would exceed last year's value, and it was based primarily on improvement in wheat value exports and horticulture. Given where we are now, does a billion bushel plus export still look feasible and realistic, or should we start to expect a little bit of a reduction in maybe the USDA export forecast going forward?
Well, I'll start. Everyone's going to have their own opinion here, and realize you're dealing with competitors and suppliers here, so we'll all try our best. I think a billion bushels is not out of the question yet, though the window's closing, and it's closing rapidly. We do see some reason for optimism. Black Sea values are at some of their highest levels we've seen in the last couple of years. Australian values are at extremely high levels compared to recent valuations, prices they haven't seen since the back-to-back droughts they had in 07, 08. So the potential for a big increase in the first half of 2019 is there. Though I just spent the last 2 weeks with the U.S. Wheat Associates over in Asia traveling with one of Kurt's co-workers that he works with that hit Pacific Corps and some of the other people in the trade, the U.S. Wheat people that work with Michael. And the buyers there didn't seem like they were in any rush. They seemed pretty happy to stay hand-to-mouth. The Black Sea values have not cut off yet. They still want to shop, and they still want to get the best price. So that kind of took me aback a little bit. I thought at this point I would start to see a little bit of panic setting in. Oh, no, the U.S. is all that's left. We all got to start scrambling to secure supply before the price goes up. And I didn't get that sense at all. I think that Indonesia, Vietnam, Latin America definitely, some of these countries that in the past have relied heavily on the Black Sea will shift to the U.S., but to get to a billion bushels, it's going to have to start happening a lot faster than it's happening now.
Yeah, I don't disagree. I think that there's kind of a good news and a bad news with this. And the good news is that P&W wheat exports tend to be much more static than total U.S. wheat exports. So when we see big gains or reductions, it's typically in U.S. Gulf exports. This year, our own internal projections are that we'll be near record for total wheat exports out of the P&W. So if we don't realize or don't get to a billion bushel number, which would be driven by some type of Russian export tariff or export limitation and probably an increase in hard red and soft red exports to supplement that into North Africa or maybe into Brazil. Even if we don't see that in Q3 and Q4 of the marketing year, I don't think it necessarily impacts what we're going to do out of the P&W. There is some crossover competition, as you mentioned, with Black Sea wheat into places like Indonesia, and that is significant. But I do think that a lot of our buyers, particularly Asian buyers, are still hoping for that Christmas present under the tree of a bigger Western Australian crop. And I think they're going to find an empty box when they open it here because the crop, in our opinion at least, really isn't there. And the good news for growers in this region, primarily soft white growers, is it's provided a good stable market. It's a market that, while I'm not wildly bullish, I'm certainly not bearish. And I think we should have good price stability at least through the summer, or at least until harvest. And so I think we're a little bit insulated in terms of price from the impact if we don't quite reach that billion bushel target.
Ditto.
How about questions from you all?
The next questioner asks where China goes for soybeans when they can't come to the U.S. Also, is China ramping up its own soybean production? Harmon starts, followed by Liedl.
So the function of the market ever since the imposition of kind of countervailing duties, the function of the global market has been to supply China with soybeans that come from anywhere but the U.S. Okay, they've also tried for incremental purchases of other feedstuffs or feed meal, canola meal, propeller palm meal, express palm meal pellets, anything they can do. But those are on the orders of a couple of million tons a year, and they're going to import, well, now the latest projection, 90 million metric tons of soybeans in a year. So what we've done is we've stripped South America clean of soybeans. We've even exported soybeans from Argentina to the point where the U.S. is selling Argentina soybeans so that they can crush and export meal. We're shipping Canadian soybeans in record numbers and sending U.S. soybeans to Canadian processors to crush. We've stripped all the supplies out of Europe so that some of that has come back to the U.S. Gulf as U.S. soybeans into Europe that were being supplied out of Brazil. So you have this massive trade dislocation to fuel that demand into China. And this is where I kind of get back to the statement about it being political and less economic. Right? They're bearing a high cost to do this. And it is to arm wrestle us over trade in other areas, right? But they're bearing a high cost to do it. We're bearing a high cost to do it as an industry.
Mr. Harmon, as usual, is right on. There's a lot of inefficiencies being created in the market, but these inefficiencies are being driven for political reasons. As Kurt talked about when he first started, we can sell beans plus tariff values into China cheaper than they can buy them out of South America right now. But I think the big political goal for the People's Republic of China is to show they can make it all the way through to new crop supplies out of South America late January, February, without having to take U.S. beans. If they can prove one entire year's worth of independence from U.S. supply, I think it strengthens their position in any future trade arguments. So I think they're close enough now that they're going to do whatever it takes to get over that hump, get to that first boat out of South America loading on January 20th or 30th, and they're going to make it somehow. So going forward, this could all be fixed in a phone call, but it doesn't look like anyone's setting up for that phone call right now.
A follow-up questioner asked Lidl how long it would take to fill the pipeline once that phone call is made and a solution is agreed upon. Harmon follows with Phylon batting cleanup.
Well, if it were the true magic bullet that everything's fixed, tomorrow's business as usual, you'd immediately see cargoes being canceled out of South America, cargoes that have been bought for November, December, January, and they would be immediately rolled back to the Pacific Northwest because there's a gigantic financial incentive. Selling out your freight and replacing your freight into another port is a highly liquid and easily done thing in the market, and the market spreads will bear that cost very, very quickly. You know, this is, again, under the assumption the silver bullet exists and it gets fired.
Yeah, probably 30 days, you know, to execute. We have the shortest lead time off the PNW. We have the shortest transit time, most efficient internal system, products in position. You know, it could execute really quickly. But as Brian pointed out, South American harvest planting pace was ahead of normal. Their harvest will likely be early because of that. They've had a big incentive to expand acreage, obviously. So the very first beans that can be cut and trucked to port will be put on a ship for China. And so our window narrows dramatically. And what traditionally is our really busy soybean season of October through December and even into Jan, Feb, March, where we start to lose again to South America, right now is probably on the order of a December 15 to Jan 30 window, where, as he said, if it was magically solved overnight.
If China doesn't get solved, what the think tanks are telling us is that we could see an 8 million acre change in what the U.S. is planting next year. You would see 8 million less acres of soybeans, possibly 4 million more acres of wheat, and also another 4 million more acres of corn. And I see December corn futures are at $4 for next year, which puts corn at $160 in the basin, which is as high as we've been the last 3 years. You know, so we're trying to encourage our customers to sell some corn. So,
another questioner pointed to the fact that when China is included in world wheat stocks, the stocks-to-use ratio is at 36%. But without China, the stocks-to-use ratio is at 20%. Will China draw from their stocks in order not to buy U.S. wheat? Lidl starts the order, followed by Harmon.
Yeah, that's a good question. So China has been the wheat black hole when it comes to statistics for a long time. They do have roughly half the world's stocks hanging out in China. and their total global trade is somewhere in the area of their exports are 1 to 2 million metric tons, which is practically nothing. So we look at some of those same things. Is it worth even including a global stock situation with China if they're completely removed from the world trade matrix, in essence? And they still do a small amount of importing under their TRQ system. In the past, the U.S. had been getting a lot of that business. Now it's primarily going to Canada, Australia, maybe before the values rallied. But it appears as though China is more than self-sufficient on wheat. They have adequate wheat stocks to cover their own use. What they bring in is for blending high-quality wheat products, but they can source that other places. But what you're hinting at, on the other hand, though, is the world wheat stock situation is not as ample as it can appear on paper. Because you remove China, and then furthermore, there's only three total countries that hold significant stocks of wheat when it comes to the USDA balance sheet at the end of this year. There's China, there's India, and India exports even less wheat than China, and the United States. Matter of fact, you take China and India completely out, the United States has more stocks than the next 11 countries combined. So when it comes down to available world stocks for the market, the way this year's set up, according to the USDA balance sheet, is it's going to be the U.S. and nobody else. Everybody else's stocks-to-use ratios are under 10, and some countries, such as Argentina, gets ridiculously small. They have like a 1.2% stocks-to-use ratio, which is physically impossible in some people's estimation. So if there were to be another supply disruption, another Australia, or a problem in Canada, or even a problem in the U.S., there is not, especially if there were a problem in the Black Sea, there is no other reserve of easily available wheat in the world outside of the United States.
Yeah, there's a big move within the industry, and actually USDA is studying how to state the numbers two ways, right? State world numbers, including China and without China. And in part because there is no objective measure of their statistical analysis or their statistics. They're a state secret. They're internalized. People have discredited them for many years. They suddenly find production. They suddenly find stocks when it's convenient. One of the reasons I think it's a little less significant in wheat, and we can, I hate to say, largely ignore what their statistics say, is that in terms of the wheat they buy from us, it's different than what they grow in the North China Plain. You think about it in real U.S. simple terms, what they grow in the North China Plain is Kansas hard wheat. Okay, what they buy from us is Montana spring wheat and Washington, Idaho, Oregon soft white wheat. And they're making different products in the South with that, and with those imports, than they are with their base production there. So whether they're, you know, surplus or deficit in that production year to year, there's still a growing import demand with the affluent middle class in the South that wants those imports. Unfortunately, right now, they're being serviced by Canada and Australia. They'd very much like to continue to be serviced by us.
The revision to China's corn stocks was discussed in episode 110. Stocks rose magically by millions of bushels. A questioner asked why the U.S. Department of Agriculture embraces China's statistics in their own numbers. Harmon speaks first, followed by Fortenberry. Filin leads off the closing discussion with Harmon speaking last.
There was widespread discussion in the industry just with this last report that China makes this announcement without really any explanation. They go back 10 years, they adjust all the production and all the stocks in corn dramatically, adjusting acreage as if they suddenly found acres. And the USDA blindly adopted it in the next report without really a discussion. Yeah, and like I say, there's a big discussion, I think, within the industry, but even within USDA themselves about how do they go and about producing either two sets of statistics or completely ignoring China in their statistics.
One thing I will say, and maybe you will disagree with this or maybe you won't, but as you're looking at Chinese statistics from USDA, you ought to ground sense those with the ag attaché reports, because often they vary significantly, and those are guys that are actually on the ground there trying to, you know, they're not surveying maybe systematically like USDA would do here, but they have maybe a better sense of what's actually going on than what shows up in say, a WASD or a wheat outlook report, right. At least in the short run.
No, that's fair, and I think the ag attaché is closer to reality on soybeans, too.
Yeah, I think that's probably true. Any of you guys have any last-minute comments you want to make before we close it out?
A couple things. One thing I've noticed in the last 37 years in the grain business is the things that have changed us is in the 1980s, I called on 80 accounts to export grain in Washington, Oregon, and Idaho to the PNW export market. Today in Washington, Oregon, and Idaho, there's less than 25 accounts that we're calling on to ship grain. So consolidations and mergers. The next thing is the technology. At Continental Grain Company, the difference between Tri-Cities Grain and Continental Grain Company is 8 of us can do the same thing that 35 people used to do back in the 80s. Just the technology, the phones, cell phones. We could never get a hold of farmers. We'd call them at nights and things like that back in the 80s and in the 90s. And now with cell phones and text, it's just amazing. It's, you know, we can get the word out very, very quickly with big groups on who's growing what and doing things. One thing that's happened here just in the last 2 or 3 months, fake news, alternative facts. We had a run on soybean futures up 30 cents a bushel because this was maybe about 2-3 weeks ago, and we've had it happen a couple times, is one of the ministers of the Black Sea, Russian ministers, says we're going to slow down exports and stop exports. Wheat was up 10 cents that day. Soybeans were up 30 cents. Unbelievable. And then that night is another minister said, no, no, he spoke out of turn. That's not going to happen. We crashed back down. So you're seeing this market in a yo-yo. You know, at least a small volatility. You know, it already did its $1 and $2 per bushel drops right after Memorial Day weekend with those tweets. But just it's an interesting time that just with what things are, and it seems like it's a really, really small world where it used to be pretty big. So.
Yeah, we used to say buy the rumor, sell the fact. Now we say buy the tweet.
So,
and sell it before the next one. But
I've made the point before, but I'll make it again here. The wheat industry is huge and complicated, and its importance is growing along with the population of the planet and the need to feed the bellies of 9 billion, about 2 billion more than exists today, in 30 short years. Say what you will about corn and soybeans and their myriad of alternative uses, neither of them has the versatility of wheat when it comes to making delicious food products. That's all the time we have. I hope you will join me next week for another exciting episode of the Washington Grain Commission-sponsored podcast of Wheat All About It!
You think we're simple, you think we're not right. Look at your cities and ask yourself who's right. We've got country and you've got crime. We've got green and you've got grime. Let there be no doubt, we have what it takes to till the soil until our back aches. Just give us a break and don't be so rude. We love the work and you love the food.
We feed you.